Our guest today is known as Bonsi Chillups on Twitter. Bonsi and I actually have quite a history together, as we were classmates growing up and were even invited to each other's weddings, though they were both unfortunately derailed last year due to COVID. Bonsi is an incredibly smart guy who focuses on public equities investing at a multi-billion dollar single family office, and I'm excited to dig into the way he thinks about investing today. Bonsi, we're thrilled to be speaking with you today, and welcome to the Circle of Confidence.
Awesome. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Definitely. I don't know if I'm going to be able to not laugh and call you Bonsi the whole time. It's truly a ridiculous Twitter handle.
Yeah, that's fine. I get a lot of chuckles over it. I like, you know, I like basketball. Was a big, you know, like those early Pistons teams. So like Chauncey Billups was a favorite player of mine. And one day I was just sitting there and kind of toying, and I was like, Bonsi Chillups is a pretty cool name. So ended up going with it.
All right, cool. Well, Bonsi, I've known you for a while. I know that you are a very smart guy. You're doing a lot of really impressive work at the fund and family that you work for. Your day job is investing in public equities. And I know that you're personally a very passionate investor. So where I kind of want to start and just lay the groundwork for the rest of the conversation is understanding what are and if there are any key differences between how you invest your own money and construct your portfolio versus how you do that as a member of a family office for this multi-billion dollar family, or are the principles all the same? Mainly would just like to understand what the different consideration factors are here, like time horizon or the amount of capital you have, whether you're doing a offensive or defensive strategy or anything else that comes to mind.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting, even though the commas with regards to the money involved are significantly different between, you know, my account and the accounts that we manage here, are significantly different. The same principles kind of apply, in my opinion. I invest my money very similarly to the way that we invest our money here. Honestly, it would be a little bit of a waste if I, you know, intuitively had one way to invest money that I thought was the best, but then was in my, you know, recommendation and kind of role as a fiduciary for the you know, family that I work for said, we should be investing this way with your money, but I'm going to invest this way with my money. So similar to how guys will say they, you know, invest in their own funds, majority of net worth is in their own funds, et cetera. I just look at those 90% of the time. If I recommend they invest in something, it's because I want to be invested in it, am invested in it, think we should be invested in it, et cetera. So, you know, there every now and then there is some, some differentiation between our portfolio collectively and my individual portfolio. That doesn't necessarily stem from me thinking that the investments that I make in my PA that we don't share here are not good for them, but there's also, you know, we basically work, it's not necessarily by committee. I work with other investors and those other investors. I work with three other guys and they're all really sharp, brilliant, come from different backgrounds, view things. We all kind of have an agreed upon similar investment philosophy, but they can view things differently. And there are times just in discussions where, you know, I may have a very high conviction view of something or feel of something, but if another, you know, if some of the other guys I work with don't share that view, then it's just harder to put into the portfolio and have us all collectively make that as a bet. So there's also times where, you know, something maybe doesn't get into the portfolio simply because we have differences of agreement about a position. You know, like a certain example right now, just to give you practice, I was like KKR, private equity company. Like, I really like it. Some of the guys I work with have some reasons that they don't necessarily dislike it, but don't think it's as good of a risk reward as I do. So that's just a situation where occasionally, you know, you have a position that ends up being, you know, a little bit different between my PA and but the same principles apply. I'm applying the same principles. I'm I'm sure I should give, you know, the disclaimer, nothing I say is investment advice. Do your own research. Doesn't mean you should run out and buy KKR just because I said I'm interested in it.
Just but, because this anonymous Twitter guy said so, you definitely shouldn't.
Yeah, if you're running out and buying stocks on, you know, hot tips from anonymous Twitter accounts, then, you know, I don't know how much a disclaimer will help you, but the disclaimer's in there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'd also love to understand kind of general portfolio theory, the way you see it. How should individuals think about their portfolio, especially in terms of public equities, which is really your world? And then like just kind of at an even higher level, you're spending all day, like your full-time job is a hedge funder analyzing public equities. What's your hot take on individuals playing the public equities game?
Yeah, so it's actually, you know, I'll have to punt to, you know, greater minds than I who, you know, really preached passive investing and indexing. And I do think most people should be doing that, but also doesn't, I don't think that that means that individual investors who are willing to put in the time can't be security selectors as well. And also there's there's a certain measure that's appropriate depending on how much time you put into this. And it's completely possible that someone can, with a majority of their, you know, net worth or investment capital, be passively invested in indexing while simultaneously making, you know, one-off investments in companies that they've, you know, spent the time to diligence and have a high degree of confidence in. I don't feel like it has to be a all or nothing. You can, you know, index with the majority of your capital while also having a, you know, a high conviction view on a certain business that maybe you've even just come across in your day-to-day life. That's something that, you know, if my wife in 2011 would have, you know, gotten a decent understanding of Lululemon and been a big fan of the brand and been able to pencil out like, okay, here's what I think the box economics are. And here's what, you know, I'm a firm believer in this brand. And I think they can 5X store count over the next, you know, 6 years. And here's what they can maybe be doing in earnings. You know, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden she needs to go out and find 19 other ideas and build a 20 stock portfolio. I think it's perfectly appropriate for her to still, you know, index with the majority of her money, but then make this one high conviction bet with a, you know, portion, 5%. You know, 3%, whatever, of her investment capital. So that's kind of how I look at it, is I don't think that it necessarily needs to be all or nothing. I'll stop there and let you ask any more questions.
Yeah. And then just in terms of overall portfolio breakdown, how do you think about your exposure to public equities?
Yeah. So I would say for me, just high level starting asset allocation, majority of my net worth is in equities and public equities. I think if you're an individual, you don't have an institutional mandate to reduce volatility, then your goal should really be the highest level of compounding possible with the volatility that you're willing to take or able to emotionally handle. And typically, I think if you really deeply buy like into the fundamental belief that like kind of the stocks for the long run mentality, then you're going to end up wanting to have the majority of your net worth in public equities, or pardon me, in equity ownership, just not debt instruments. And, you know, they're incredibly smart individuals who basically work in distressed debt and make fantastic returns. And typically what they're doing is ending up taking debt positions and end up getting equity positions through some type of restructuring or what have you. But I think for me, at least, I find equity ownership much more attractive and the most attractive asset class for anyone who wants to build any type of long-term wealth. So I just high level, you know, public equities, I think, just a way to have, you know, the majority of your net worth exposed to equity ownership of businesses. And then I think a lot of it just starts at a high level, just a fundamental belief that some businesses are better than others and some businesses are good businesses. Some businesses are not as good of businesses. And, you know, I think that really comes down to like the first question I ask myself whenever I'm evaluating any business is, it sounds really simple. It's kind of a, like just a, you know, day one business school, day one, you know, mental model, but what's the Porter's five forces for this company look like? Like what actually are the reasons why this business should be able to earn outsized returns on invested capital over a long period of time? And so that for me is just kind of the initial litmus test. And guys end up tending to group themselves, I think, into growth investors, value investors, you know, quality investors, et cetera. And personally, you know, I actually like to, there's different positions that would qualify as different styles of each of those, but all of those, I think every single position I own kind of falls into the, this business should be able to earn outsized returns on invested capital over an extended period of time due to some Porter's five or some other similar type of way of thinking about business strategy, kind of way that they can really capture value. You know, that ends up resulting in kind of like a 10 to 15 position portfolio. You know, I feel like that's the point where, you know, I know some guys that run five or six, some investors that I love and really look up to. Mark Massey is probably my favorite investor. He runs a fund called AltaRock, has for a long time. I really look up to him. He's compounded at ridiculously high rates, and I've learned a ton from reading his letters. You know, he runs like a five stock position a five stock portfolio. But for me, that is, I like having, you know, 10 to 15 is kind of sweet spot of, you know, reducing volatility enough for me, to, you know, to be bearable, and letting me make, you know, kind of enough bets. I think one of the issues with, you know, four or five bets is basically you end up, somewhat placing all your eggs in one basket. There's just the benefits of diversification. Anyone who, you know, looks at this mathematically, like really start to kick in around like that 10 to 20 position mark. I think 20 positions can be like too much for me personally to just, you know, keep up with all of them. So kind of 10, 12, 15, somewhere in there, is a decent, kind of starting point. So that's kind of how I think like top down about just portfolio construction, typically almost all equity ownership, you know, and then 10 to 15 stocks. It's kind of the bread and butter.
Yeah. And then would you mind talking through your belief, and you kind of touched on this, but your belief and exposure to utilizing various investing styles at different times?
Yeah. So that's actually something that this is probably where I would say that my personal investment philosophy differs the most from like other people that I talk to or that I interact with, is I have a decent number of people who I highly respect, who I'll talk with investments about a lot, who are very like, you know, classic compounder type investors, where they want stocks that are growing earnings at a mid-teens rate for as far as the eye can see. They really preach being less valuation sensitive and more quality sensitive. And you know, that is an investment style that I understand and am attracted to. Simultaneously, there's a lot of guys who I'll read, I'll talk with, I'll interact with, who own businesses that are growing rapidly, that are just, they have embedded optionality. They are best of breed software businesses that are growing the top line, you know, 30, 40, 50% a year, if not higher. That are, you know, terminal margins are likely to be much higher than what current margins are, and are producing enough cash that eventually capital allocation is going to allow them to, you know, accrete EPS through buybacks or M&A. And basically, you know, so they think the long-term EPS algorithm is just, you know, it's going to 10 years out, it'll be multiples of what it is now. So that, you know, that's an investment, you know, school that, you know, I'm kind of, also partial to. But then there's also guys who are the, you know, kind of historical, deep value investors who are looking at stocks that are trading, for less than tangible book value, or, situations where guys have, overly penalized the company due to historical poor capital allocation, or just really, beaten up. Just people are pessimistic on the name due to, industry trends being, it's not a secular growth story or growth rolling over. And I think it's interesting that, I own names in my portfolio that trade as low as 8x earnings and trade as high as 50x earnings. And I really look at that as one, I actually take comfort in that because we never hear walk into the office and go, oh man, value selling off today. Or, oh, thank goodness that growth is ripping today. I have no dog in the fight of which way the 10-year goes and what's that going to do to growth stocks. I own some growth stocks, some quote unquote, like what the factor models would say are like a growth stock and stocks that are sensitive to duration. And then I own some value stocks that are likely to perform better if the 10-year moves up, and that implies that real growth is going to accelerate. So that's one thing that actually emotionally is very helpful for me, is to be able to come in and I'm not wishing for some type of style to work. And I feel like I'm able to look across the investment universe and really look at my portfolio as a collection of bets. All of them, I'm hoping for the most part, at least 80% of my portfolio. And, guys will talk about having this barbell approach, and I kind of ascribe to it. 70 to 80% of my portfolio, I just want in companies, whether they're growth, value, whatever, that I think are going to be earning more 5 years from now. Like the ability to grow earnings power is pretty high up on my list. But there's also situations where it may be kind of a unique, special situation that I'm willing to put into the portfolio, even though it's not necessarily an earnings growth story, simply because I think it's an attractive risk reward. But the majority of my portfolio, I want things that are growing earnings and over a 5-10 year period. Here's the thing. I'm actually a little less sensitive to the degree to which they grow earnings as I am about the confidence in the direction of the earnings growth. That's actually, blood, like a company growing faster rather than slower. But really for me, it's kind of the terminal value of the business is like a key question mark in my investment filter. Kind of that, do I have a high degree of confidence this company will continue to grow earnings? So that's actually where I have like a company that I diligenced recently that I just have less, I'm less comfortable with. And not to say it's impossible that I'd ever get there underwriting it, but I took a quick pass on Dropbox recently and did some work on it. And it's fantastic business. Capital allocation has actually been really good. They're growing rapidly. The stock's pretty cheap. They're growing free cash flow per share, like, 20-ish percent. And they've signaled pretty good capital allocations, capital return. They're producing a lot of cash. Management's guidance, if you kind of look at the out years, they're guiding for some pretty healthy free cash flow growth. And so you kind of start to do the math and you realize, oh, hey, this could, let's say the multiple compresses a little bit or it holds a multiple, but they keep growing earnings this fast. This could be pretty attractive. But for me, the biggest risk is I just don't know 5 years out, 10 years out, what that business looks like and what the document sharing business looks like. And if you think about it, in a world where you move to kind of a cloud first ecosystems, like right now, document sharing is super attractive, is like a good business because and kind of solve the need, because if I'm on my work computer and then I go home, it's nice to be able to, pull the files up from my work computer, Dropbox, Box, solve that need. However, if you look 5-10 years out from now, why should my workstation, why should the OS that I'm running right here locally, why should that not be in the cloud? And then why should I not just be able to, on my Microsoft OS, be able to go into my file manager just from wherever I am through, whatever OneDrive or whatever it is, just my whole workstation should be in the cloud. So why should I even need, a document management system like Dropbox? And then additionally, you have Google, Microsoft, these businesses that are willing to use basically they're home base in a lot of ways. These are on ramps to work for people. Google Work, their solutions, and then Windows OS, even Zoom, just places that people like already have a very natural touch point because they have to work with this piece of software every day. It's very easy. Adobe, Adobe Reader. It's very easy for these pieces of software or platforms that people interact with every day to just introduce document sharing. And it almost makes the case, like, why would you go to an external third-party app when you can just, we'll on-ramp you right here. You can do this internally within the app you already use every day. So, I did that. I talked to a couple CIOs, CTOs who currently use Dropbox and was just asking them about the current usage and if they could imagine themselves switching, trying to understand what are the switching costs. Is there any reason why the switching costs would be so high? And talked to a couple individuals who just said that they're current Dropbox users, but that in 5 to 10 years, they don't know if, it's a competitive marketplace. And at some point they'll probably rethink that. And it's not very hard to transfer files.
Right.
That's a situation where kind of quantitatively, like, it looks really attractive, but I just couldn't get comfortable with the terminal value risk. So really everything in my portfolio for the most part has a high degree of kind of terminal value certainty. Like, if I told you the businesses, you would go, okay, that'll be around in 10 years. Companies like Lowe's and Sherwin-Williams are two that, Sherwin-Williams is a company that I love, but it's been around since the Civil War. And they've been raising prices every year since the Civil War. But then I own some companies that are high growing SaaS businesses, but at the same time, like, I have a high degree of confidence in the terminal value of those businesses. So that's kind of a decent, like, when I think about portfolio construction, that's what I'm trying to equities, 10 to 15 of them. The majority of the portfolio I want in businesses that have a high degree of confidence and the terminal value of, and even if they aren't growing rapidly, the fact that they can kind of, there's some type of, Buffett uses the term moat or whatever, but there's something there that allows them to earn outsized returns on capital. The ROIC is higher than the WACC. And that should persist because of something about the business that's impossible to replicate with just putting a set amount of capital out there and creating a lookalike. So that's kind of high level how I think about portfolio construction. And then I'll touch on this, and I kind of mentioned it to you in some notes I sent over, but I really do think a good portfolio manager, and again, that's something I'm learning to be. And as we manage capital for this family and simultaneously managing my own capital, but a good portfolio manager really has a lot of similarities to a point guard. And when I say that, really the metaphor there is, I think a lot of guys get too fixated into one investment style. And this is going back to talking about being able to go cross kind of styles. And there's some guys that I really look up to and admire who've been able to do this over a long period of time. David Tepper at Appaloosa, Bill Miller, are just guys who I feel like have been able to make money in multiple different ways and multiple different styles. And, as you're a point guard, I played point guard in high school, and as you're coming down the court, you can have a stud player, and clearly if he's being guarded by a guy who is not as good as he is, not as quick as a defender, you want to feed him. He's your stud, get him the ball, let him go to work. And in my eyes, this is kind of like those, like, classic compounders. Like, if they're not being guarded well, if they're trading at 20 times earnings, giving them the ball and let them go to work and get out of the way. Like, what are you doing trying to get too fancy? Just let the guy work, give him the ball, and just keep going back to him, keep going back to him, keep going back to him. So in an ideal situation, I basically have a platinum list, we have a platinum list of businesses that we look at, just businesses that are super high quality that we'd like to own at the right price. Those are all trading at the right price. Like, I just, you know, invest in 10 or 15 of those and, you know, go to the beach. Like that's the ideal situation. And so I kind of look at those, you know, if you think about, you know, Chauncey Billups, like he had Rip Hamilton, great shooting guard. Like, so, you know, if he comes down the court and Rip's standing there and he's being guarded by, you know, a subpar defender, just get him the ball. But then simultaneously, sometimes and you know, Rip's kind of one of those, like, again, to make the you know, metaphor work, like, I think those are your like companies that have a super high terminal value and are growing earnings rapidly, that are growing revenue rapidly. That's like your just dream situation is this is a really good price for a business that is just stellar, with regards to both growth and quality. But then there's times where in basketball, if you do that, the defense is going to double team your guy. Like a good defense will adjust, and the market is, I really hate this word because it's kind of a buzzword, but like, I think it's a decent way of just quickly getting the idea across. Like the market is a complex, adaptive system. Like it is a system that will respond to whatever you put. It's not static, it's dynamic and will change based on the actions of the players. And so when, you know, I kind of look at it as, you know, a great shooting guard getting double teamed as, you know, a company like Costco trading at 50 times earnings, you know, or Visa trading at 50 times earnings, which, you know, Visa is like at like 35 times earnings right now. And I'm not even necessarily like saying they're bad investments right here, but just there comes a time where high quality businesses get really bit up. And I think it's important at that time to then have court awareness, like scan the court. You can't just keep going back to what's worked when the guy's being double teamed. In an ideal world, you're able to just keep going to that guy. But, you know, so I feel like there's been this narrative recently that value has been, you know, this big underperformer versus growth over this, you know, last couple of 10 years. What's actually interesting is if you go back and look at the 2011 period, if you look at the difference, if you look at valuations for basically the cheapest quartile of the market, or quintile, however you want to look at it, the bottom 25%, bottom 20%. When I say market, I'm talking about S&P 500 and just the forward price earnings multiple. And then you look at the most expensive 75th percentile of the market or 80th percentile of the market, and you look at those two versus each other. 2011, actually, that spread got super tight. Basically, people were not willing to pay a whole lot more for really high quality businesses than they were willing to pay for very low quality businesses. That spread was really tight. And basically, to me, you know, there were incredibly high quality businesses. I kind of mentioned some, Sherwin-Williams, Moody's, you know, Visa. Go back and look during those periods. And there were clearly, you know, macroeconomic concerns, but Google, Apple was trading like 7 times earnings. You basically had, you know, a period of time where, and there were, you know, there were, there's clearly kind of in the middle of like Euro, you know, debt concerns and, this other, you know, stuff going on in the world. And it's hard to have hindsight bias and say, oh, everything turned out great. But still, if you look back at that period, there's an argument to be made that just high quality businesses were too cheap relative to low quality businesses. And I kind of look at that as a point guard of, okay, they're not guarding your stud. Like you got to get him the ball right now. Like give him the ball, let him go to work. If you're going to give me Google for 12 times earnings, like there's no more work to be done here. Just like that's where you got to go with the ball. You know, if you're going to give me Home Depot at 13, 14 times earnings, like that's where the ball's got to go. Now it's a little different. Now you've seen, you know, you're seeing valuation kind of disparities where, you know, the top decile or quintile of the market is trading, you know, it versus the bottom, you know, 10% or 20% at ridiculous, kind of a ridiculous spread. So like that leads me to believe like you're likely in a position where your stud is being covered really well. And you're trying to see, are there any situations where they're leaving Ben Wallace, who is a terrible offensive player, wide open under the basket? And can you just get him the ball and pray to God, he turns around and dumps it. So I basically look at his investing as like this constant, like you're trying to come up with kind of what like 5-year IRRs are, 10-year IRRs, long-term IRRs for all these businesses. And you're just trying to pass the ball to whoever has the best IRR of the next kind of 10 years at any given time. And sometimes that's in ultra high quality businesses, and sometimes that's not. It's in, you know, more middling quality businesses. You know, right now, I think, and I'm not saying, here's the thing as well, is sometimes you pass the ball to Jordan and he's double teamed and he scores. Like, still, like, that's not to say that, you know, you can't ever make money by investing in a very high quality business at what looks like a high valuation. You know, all that good jazz about good companies and good management teams, surprise to the upside, is, you know, makes a lot of sense and has happened historically. You know, I think people may be getting lulled to sleep a little bit simply because we've had such a long period of multiple expansion. I mean, basically since the financial crisis, multiples have gone straight up. I mean, but also to kind of argue back against that and to rebut my own point, like there's reasons why that could be the case. Like, you know, just firsthand, there's or kind of like the first level, you know, thinking is just interest rates have gone lower. And if you think of the earnings yield as some type of spread to, you know, the 10 year, 20 year, 30 year, then, you know, that's potentially justified. And I'm not even saying interest rates have gone lower because the Fed's been manipulating it. Like that could honestly just be because real growth expectations and inflation expectations have been low. Like clearly the last 10 years was like, for all the, you know, hand-wringing about it potentially being inflationary, like it was a decently, like, you know, it was a borderline deflationary period. Like we had very low inflation. Like, and so when you have low inflation and low real growth, you get low nominal growth, and like, you know, and yields were justifiably lower than they were entering that decade, or, you know, kind of back in 2005. Like, so if you think of, you know, the forward earnings multiple is just, you know, you invert that and make it into a yield. What's the earnings yield? And then look at that versus the 10 year, the 20 year, the 30 year. Like, yeah, is that, you know, kind of the equity risk premium stays constant and yields go down. Like it can make sense for multiple to expand on. So, you know, I try not to get too caught up with trying to like make macro prognostications, everything in measure. That's why I think it is dangerous to go all in on value or all in on growth or whatever. I like to keep a portfolio that's a little bit more balanced so that I don't walk in. And I just don't like walking into the office or looking at my personal account and thinking, oh gosh, I've got to have this style perform well, or this factor has got to perform well. And if it doesn't in the next 2-3 years, like, you know, it's just not going to look good. So that's kind of how I know I've talked for a while.
Great. I really love that analogy of the point guard. Like that honestly was kind of a light bulb moment for me in like thinking about different strategies. So thank you for that. We've spent a little bit of time at the beginning talking about, is it a good business? I think the other side of that equation is it priced well? I want to get to that, but before we get to that, I just thought that was really interesting talking about how you use different strategies. Like you've got businesses that are trading at 8x earnings and some at 50x earnings. That is, you know, if your fundamental goal is to compound capital at the highest rates of return, utilizing different strategies definitely opens up the universe of opportunities, which is good and bad, right? Like it's good because you have more opportunities. It's bad because you just have, I don't know if it's necessarily bad, it's just maybe harder because you have so many more evaluations to make. So I know you mentioned the platinum list, but just where do you start? I mean, when you're able to look at any public equity, almost like walk us through a case study of where would you start? How would you narrow down different opportunities? How do you analyze an opportunity? And then I think at the end, we can kind of move into how are you pricing opportunities?
Yeah. So first off, how to like, you know, generate ideas or think of, you know, an opportunity. I mean, honestly, a lot of it is, it's kind of this, you know, it's very, there's a lot of spontaneity involved in that, you know, it'll be all over the place. I'm listening to what other investors are finding interesting. I'm reading a lot of investor presentations that companies are giving. If I see a company give an investor presentation, I try to just spend 15, 20 minutes quickly to just look through it to see if it even like piques my attention. You know, some people don't like doing that, but because they feel that, you know, listening to management could mislead them. But I typically find that, you know, if I look through the investment presentation and I, you know, think it's interesting in 15 minutes, like I'm a decently skeptical person. So I tend to spend the rest of my, you know, work trying to kind of disprove management's thesis and basically say, okay, how could what they were saying be bullcrap? But if management can lay out like a decent case, you know, for 4 years, 5 years out of what they think, you know, they think they can compound, you know, EPS rapidly, or that EBIT should be significantly higher in the out years. Like, I just think that's like, okay, that's your hypothesis. Now let's probe it. So that's a way that I'll generate ideas. Every now and then I'll use screens. I'm not a big screens guy. I honestly just print out kind of like the top 500 to 1,000 largest companies in the world. And we do that and just look through them every week, basically see what's been moving. You know, what are the forward multiples? What's been the relative performance historically? And then honestly, a thing that I like to do is, you know, and then part of it's just from reading the news. Part of it's from just doing work on certain names and trying to get to understand them. And so like, for example, right now it's been big that Ackman is, you know, he's taking public, you know, he's going to help take public UMG through, you know, Universal Music Group through PSTH and his Tontine Holdings, you know, SPAC. And he laid out a presentation on why he thinks the you know, music publishers are really good businesses. You know, I have, I'm very interested in Spotify. I've spent a lot of time diligence in Spotify. So I've spent a lot of time on that business, understanding just kind of, you know, what can happen with Spotify and the publishers and that relationship there. And I'm a little bit more of the view that people think it's like an antagonistic relationship, but actually the two should be able to coexist pretty well. And that Spotify and the music publishers can both, you know, grow earnings, revenue and earnings pretty, you know, a pretty healthy clip from here. And that we're a long ways off from really having a fight for it being a zero sum game. I think they're kind of mutually beneficial right now. But yeah, so anyways, I look at that. I'm like, you know what? I like the music publisher business. This is a pretty attractive business. And simultaneously, I cover the video game space. And so I like the video game business a lot, you know, and I keep up with it. And one of the, you know, I like the game publishers, but then I also like PlayStation. Sony owns PlayStation. And so it's like, you know, I really think that's a fantastic business. I know historically the hardware business has not been as good of a one because you basically have to make hardware at somewhat cost. But what's different about, you know, the video game console developers businesses versus prior years is now so much more of the revenue comes from first party software development. So first party studios. So like PlayStation makes games and they have these in-house studios. So basically they'll sell you the console at cost, but then they end up earning really high margins on this first party software that they sell, the games that they sell. And then they also have people subscribing to like PlayStation Plus, and these other subscription services on top of it. And then they take a cut off of everything bought over the PlayStation store. So basically all of a sudden you have this app store-ish marketplace that they're just taking a cut off of everything that gets purchased as a digital download, or most everything gets purchased. So I think about it and say, man, that's a very good business. So then I'm just like, I'm interested to look at Sony's, and I've been decently familiar with Sony. I'm like, all right, well, I need to catch back up. How much of their operating income comes from the music publisher and how much of their operating income comes from this video game business? Like, I really like both of these businesses just through reading and like building up knowledge, like of, you know, different spaces. Like, all right, how much of this? Then you start doing the work and you're like, all right, this is getting close to like 50% of their operating income. And then you say, all right, well, let's kind of do like a sum of the parts like analysis here, and you know, what would I pay for just that music publishing business, and what would I pay for just you know, that video game business? And you know, I'm always a little careful with some of the parts analyses, because a quote I heard one time that I really liked said the issue with some of the parts models or that some of the parts aren't worth anything. And so I mean, I kind of, you know, I think it's always worth, and then additionally, like, look, this is a Japanese conglomerate, and Japanese conglomerates don't exactly have the best history of, you know, delivering shareholder value. But, you know, so I start looking at the sum of the parts and seeing if it's attractive. And, you know, so I'm just doing a project on Sony right now, because I'm like, you know, I like those two businesses. I look at the, you know, the forward multiple, and I'm like, the earnings multiple is only like 15 times earnings. I'm like, man, there's no way that if those two businesses were trading, you know, publicly listed pure play businesses, that they would be at 15 times earnings. Like, there must be some significant kind of conglomerate discount being applied right now. So basically it just starts work. You're trying to get into like, all right, what could EPS be in 5 years from now? Then, can I trust this management team? What has this management team been doing? You know, they've started to change more of the compensation to return on invested capital aligned compensation, which is actually very unique and surprising to see a Japanese company do. That's not historically been, you know, kind of a Japanese corporate governance practice. They've started buying back some shares, which is again, not something that's normal in Japan. So you're starting to see, okay, this is interesting. They're starting to look a little bit more shareholder friendly from a corporate governance perspective. There might be some assets in here that the market is kind of discounting just due to the, you know, hold co nature of Sony. Yeah. And so that just leads me to like start doing work on it. And I've basically going in, I've got no, like I don't have a desire to buy Sony. Like I hope it turns out it was a good investment, but I think that's part of it as well, is like not getting too excited, like holding yourself back while working on an idea, like making sure you don't get, can't remember one time, says like cocaine brain when you start thinking about an idea and like how much money you can make, like being rational in your decision making of like, all right, what's my downside as well, and like clearly articulating like, you know, what can go wrong with, you know, an investment in this business. And like for every business that I own, like I should be able to explain very clearly, like here's how I could lose money, like here's the bet and here's how the bet could go wrong. I think a lot of people, you know, get so bullish on companies that they're almost unable to articulate clearly, here's the bet and here's how it could go wrong, very succinctly. For almost every company I own, I try to go through that process of saying, here's how this goes wrong, here's how I lose money in this investment. And just having an understanding of that. And I feel like that kind of just over time doing that builds up a decent risk management kind of muscle, and also helps me be a little bit more engaged and kind of on the same page whenever I'm talking to someone who's, you know, maybe a bear or less bullish on names that I follow than I do.
Yeah. I think you've told me before that you guys don't do DCFs. So like in terms of valuation, what are you doing?
Yeah. So we don't do DCFs simply because there's just a lot of, and now I will say this, we have a DCF mentality because a business, we like, I firmly believe, and everyone here firmly believes, a business is worth how much cash it spits out over the all of its life, discounted back to today based on how risky that investment is. Like that is what something is worth, either that or what a rational buyer will pay for it. But if you don't want to speculate on, you know, what a rational buyer will pay for something, then a business is only worth however much cash it's going to produce over the rest of its life, discounted back to today based on some assessment of the risk. Now, with that said, we just think that, and I will say personally, I'll speak for myself, I don't know that I believe that a DCF is the best way to actually estimate that intrinsic value, because there are so many assumptions that are highly variable. I mean, build a DCF and play around with the long-term growth rate and WACC and the spread between those two, that R minus G drives so much. And so basically, you know, the difference between having, you know, your R, your WACC be 6 and your G, your long-term growth be 2.5, and thus you have a spread of 3.5, and your G be 2 and your R be 7 and having a spread of 5, like those don't sound like, you know, worlds of it, but like it makes such a big difference in the outcome of valuation. So, I mean, basically the way I think, you know, about valuation is building out a, you know, kind of 5-year, 6-year, 7-year forward model, however you think you can get to normalized earnings, 10 years, maybe at times. Like I think I've done a 10-year model once when I was looking at Amazon and trying to understand like 10 years out, what could all their businesses like get to from an EBIT margin perspective, and like how big could they be. I think that's the only time I've ever built a 10-year model that actually felt like really was better than a 7-year model or a 5-year model. But most of the time, 5-7 year model, and then try to get an understanding of what earnings per share can grow to, and really, or free cash flow per share at the end of the day. Like that's, you know, a business needs to be able to grow and free cash flow on a per share basis. And that's kind of what I'm looking for. And so, you know, that basically is what can they grow revenue at? What can margin, how will margins change over that period? Should margins leverage, deleverage? And then, so you kind of get EBIT growth. And then, you know, you're at that point, you're talking about interest and basically what, you know, how does net debt change over that period. So what should happen to that interest line? You're down to pre-tax profit. You're trying to understand what, you know, pre-tax profit is going to grow as a function of EBIT growth versus growth in interest expense or interest income. Apply a tax rate. Are there any changes in tax rate? You get down to net income. And then you've got net income. And then you go to the cash flow statement. And you start with that net income and you're trying to figure out, I mean, it's just Buffett's owner's earnings, add back any depreciation and amortization, figure out if there's any changes in working capital, particularly permanent ones. That's what I'm more interested in than does a business have a 1-year release, working capital release. Much more interested in is a business like actually a negative working capital business. Is it a subscription business that people, you know, pay early? And so, you know, revenue isn't recognized until the entire, like, you know, subscription has been used up, but they get the cash up front. You know, that's a persistent negative working capital model. And so, you know, you got that net income, adding back any depreciation, amortization, you know, accounting for any changes in net working capital, particularly ones that should be permanent. And then you get down to that cash from operations, subtract out any recurring capital investments that will need to be made, that CapEx, kind of left with free cash flow to the equity owner. And so I just think of that right there. And then what are they going to do with that? So that's the question. This is actually where I think it's not as hard to forecast. It can be, but it can be a fairly simple exercise to forecast. Like, what do you think in a couple of years out a company can earn a free cash flow to the equity holders? Question though, is what do they do with that? What's their capital allocation? That's a question that I spend a lot of time trying to answer is what's management going to do with this? And I mean, you know, there's the book, The Outsiders, Will Thorndike, but basically talks about the 5 uses of capital allocation. There's, you can reinvest in the business, you know, additional, you know, projects above and beyond just the normal course of business. You can go buy another business. You can pay down debt. You can pay a dividend. Or you can buy back shares. And so personally for me, a model that actually really, you know, works well is, you know, and something that I look for is, are there businesses with, you know, you think about any business, it generates a return on assets or a return on, generates return on assets. And then you kind of have to ask yourself, all right, how much of that's tangible assets and did they have to acquire anything? You know, and that those two will tell you how much invested capital is in the business. So then you can figure out, okay, what's the return on invested capital that this business should produce? So you kind of start with ROA, then you can get down to ROIC. What's the return on invested capital that this business can produce? How much equity capital in, how much debt capital in? And then can I lever that safely? And so if you can lever that return on invested capital, you can have a mediocre return on invested capital, but get a very attractive return on equity. And this is the bank model, like very low ROA with lots of leverage leads you to an okay ROE. Now, the question, what's hard about banks is you don't actually know a lot of times with these large global banks, what's in what those assets are made up of. And there's so much leverage. So let's say that, you know, you're levered 10 to 1. These banks are levered 10 to 1 to generate an acceptable, you know, and they're generating a 2% ROA, giving you a 20% ROE. Approximately, just using shorthand here. But then all of a sudden, it turns out that 3% or 5% of the assets, you know, had to be marked down or written off. And I mean, this is an excessive situation. But, you know, if you're levered 10 to 1, and turns out just something happened to 5% of your asset base, I mean, your equity's down 50%. And so that's what's always been difficult with for me about investing in banks is just the black box nature of them, the inability to actually understand what the assets are that make up, you know, that allow them to generate this. They're generating this low ROA on this asset base and then levering it to get a, you know, higher return on equity. But you can look at businesses, you know, the John Malone, the U.S. cable business, that's one that historically okay return on invested capital, not great, but can handle a lot of leverage due to the, you know, low cyclicality. And so people aren't canceling their cable subscriptions. And so you're just able to run this, you know, kind of levered buyback model. If you look at Altice, what they've done, I mean, they've run with leverage 4 or 5 times and just bought back tons of shares. So kind of as I'm talking about that last line, what's that capital allocation? What are they going to do? Completely different capital allocation. You have you know, Salesforce, who's just been incredibly acquisitive, you know, that they've done so in large acquisitions, which are a little less, you know, appetizing to me. I think there's some research showing that, you know, larger acquisitions, I think there's a research paper that says that basically the finding was that acquisitions that are done when the acquirer is buying a company that is more than like 10% of the enterprise value of the acquirer tend to be less successful. Basically, I mean, in layman's terms, roll-up strategies are better than like large transformative M&A most of the time. Again, that's most of the time. So if you look at like, you know, Constellation Software, or there's some industrial companies that have done this for long periods of time that have just rolled up industries. You know, Constellation Software has bought, you know, small business critical software businesses. And, you know, that's another, they've basically redirected the majority of free cash flow to acquisitions. So it doesn't necessarily be, it doesn't have to be share buybacks or it doesn't have to be acquisitions. Sometimes the prudent thing to do is pay down debt. Sometimes, you know, a company's trading at 3 times, 4 times, or is levered at 3 or 4 times EBITDA, but the business is so cyclical that basically equity investors are not willing to pay a very high multiple for the earnings due to the cyclicality of the earnings. And honestly, questions around if it's an appropriate leverage ratio. So sometimes taking your leverage down from 4 turns to 2 turns, paying down debt can cause your multiple to expand to a point that, you know, leaves the stock price higher. So it's not always, you know, it's not a one size fits all. I just want them to buy back shares. I just want them to pay a dividend. Sometimes it's pay a dividend. Sometimes, like, there's a business, for example, Sirius Satellite Radio. Actually, Dropbox. I'll use Dropbox. Like, you know, if you invest in Dropbox, you just have to really bet that they're going to be prudent capital allocators. Like, they're going to produce a lot of cash, but you just have to bet that, they're going to be really smart with it and thread the needle. Like, I would feel much more comfortable buying Dropbox probably. I mean, here, look, 10 years from now, I may be eating my words. Dropbox could be taking over the world, $200 billion business, and has completely just blown past all my fears. So, you know, bookmark this. But I mean, if I could buy you know, Dropbox for the price that it traded at 4 or 5 months ago and do that and just buy the whole business and take it private. And I knew what the capital allocation was going to be, that it wasn't going to be an attempt at some large transformative M&A, that basically it was going to be able to dividend out all of the cash flow. I think you could make an argument, hey, this thing's going to produce more cash over the next 10, 15 years than it's trading for right now. And you're going to get a pretty decent return. Just take the cash out of the business. Don't try to reinvest it in this business. You know, so a lot of it depends on, it's like, all right, well, how much cash are you going to produce? And then what's the capital allocation going to be? You know, that's historically, these Japanese holdcos trade at significant discounts to what, you know, if they were broken up, people say is intrinsic value, because I mean, they're not paying a dividend. They're not buying back shares. They're not returning capital to shareholders. They're going to go to more acquisitions. So you're never going to see the cash. So, you know, that is, for me, you get down to that. You kind of get EBIT growth over a period of time. And then interest is really tied into how much debt the company has. So that's why I kind of just skipped over that. You got net income, you get free cash flow. Then what's the company doing with that capital, that free cash flow that they're producing? Are they going to buy back shares? And is that prudent? Are they going to pay a dividend? Is that prudent? Are they going to pay down debt? Should they be doing that? Are they going to make acquisitions? What's the acquisition set look like? Who can they acquire? Now, there's some companies that are able to acquire small independent mom and pops for 6x EBITDA or 7x EBITDA, and then they trade publicly for 12, 13, 14 times EBITDA. I mean, that's immediately accretive. You want to do that all day. If you can buy it 6x, and I'm sure you're getting some synergies, because a lot of these businesses, you know, they end up just plugging into their larger platform and having more of like a systematized back office presence. And so you get some synergies on that 6x, and then it trades, you know, at 14x or 13x or 12x or whatever these, you know, the parent company trades at. Like, you know, that's a repeatable playbook that is, you know, I could underwrite as a prudent use of capital. So that's again, like how I think about not doing a DCF. You come up with kind of, what do I think revenue can grow at? What do I think, how do I think margins will evolve over this period? What's interest expense going to be because of what they do with debt? How does that grow net income? And then how does that grow EPS? What if they just buy back all the shares? You know, there's a lot of companies that just, that there's a couple companies around that they just say, we're going to buy back shares with excess free cash flow. And so then you know, you get net income growing in a certain amount, but, you know, EPS persistently grows at a higher rate because all the capital is being returned through a share buyback. If you look at AutoZone's a company that historically, like, you know, grew net income at a decent clip. They were able to open a lot of boxes, and, you know, AutoZone was actually a pretty good business. But if you go back, AutoZone's been like one of the biggest monsters of like the past 20 years, 25, 30 years, because it just kept opening boxes, kept growing EBIT. Then it kept growing net income. The stock never traded a ridiculous multiple because there were always kind of secular concerns about electronic vehicles. It's not really a sexy business. And the stock was trading at 11, 12, 13, 14 times earnings, or basically like 8% free cash flow yield over that period. So they were growing earnings, you know, at 8, 9, 10%, growing net income at that rate while simultaneously buying back their stock with all their excess free cash flow at an 8% free cash flow yield. And here's the thing, is they were doing it with a little bit of leverage. So, you know, if you've got 2 turns of leverage on and you grow EBITDA $1, but then you're levered 2x, you not only get your $1 to go buy back shares with, you get two more that you're going to, because you're going to borrow more, and then you're going to go buy back your shares with that as well. So $1 of EBIT growth turns into $3 of a share buyback. So that, for AutoZone over the years, that playbook, the levered buyback model, has just been a massive wealth creator. There's a bunch of people in Memphis, Tennessee, that just call AutoZone millionaires, just been with the business, you know, good old boys who've been with the business for just 20 years who are just stuck around, and the stock just keeps going up and to the right. So, you know, just trying to get an understanding of what then all those different things can lead to for kind of a 5-year out, 7-year out earnings per share number. And then the guesswork is putting a multiple on that. So then that's kind of the art of it, is putting the multiple on it and understanding what that implies from kind of an IRR perspective. Okay, the stock's here today. I think earnings grow here, go to here, and this should trade at this type of multiple. I'll get this type of dividend yield over that time frame. And then if it trades at this at the end, that implies this type of IRR.
I want to go back to just based on everything you've said on how you look for opportunities, how you evaluate opportunities, and the analogy of the point guard. Where are you passing the ball today?
Yeah, I'd probably say I actually think there's a decent number of, it's kind of interesting. I talked about really high quality businesses, like super high quality businesses. I think a lot of those are trading at valuations that are fairly demanding. It's not to say that they can't work out, but they need most things to go right to work out. And then simultaneously, I do see some businesses that are, people are pretty pessimistic on kind of their growth prospects. I do see a number of businesses that I would call quality businesses that are not world beaters, but are good businesses that have been around for a long time and will grow earnings, you know, kind of 10 to 15% annually, that maybe have a little bit more volatility to their earnings profile, that are, you know, they're not bond like in kind of the volatility of their earnings. I feel like there's been, you know, I love Costco. Costco's on, you know, my platinum list business I'd love to buy, but is trading at a valuation right now that I feel is pretty demanding. And a lot of that has to do with just the kind of the low terminal value risk the market assigns to it and kind of the steadiness of the earnings growth and the duration of the earnings growth. That's something I have a hard time being the marginal buyer for. But I think there's a number of businesses that actually, like, if I use the, if I go back to use the, you know, Pistons, early 2000s Pistons example, they're not quite Rip Hamilton and they're not quite Ben Wallace, but they're like Rasheed Wallace or Tayshaun Prince. Like they're guys who are like, okay, scores, like they can get it done. You know, you might get on a good night, you'll get 20 out of them. You know, and there's some businesses that I think are trading between 15 to 22 times earnings that are kind of growing at this, you know, 10 to 15% a year rate and should be able to for a long time. So honestly, the majority of my, you know, personal account right now is, you know, concentrated in, you know, handful, you know, 8 to 10 of these businesses, that, you know, I think are attractive, you know, in an absolute sense, but even more so relative to, you know, where the S&P 500 currently trades at.
All right, Bonsi, we are a little bit over time, but I want to rattle through a few hot topics with you because you've always got some fun and well thought out takes. So we won't spend much time here, but just first things that come to mind. Are you ready?
Yep, let's do it.
All right, who's the most overrated investor out there?
Oh, who's the most overrated investor out there? This one's tough. I mean, I don't know if I would say overrated. In that, you know, I would say he's, you know, not a great investor. You know, I've been picking on him a little bit on Twitter lately, but
I know who it is. Don't say it.
Seth Klarman.
No. Okay, all right.
Who?
Munger.
Munger. Oh man, I could pick on Munger. I could pick on Munger right now. Yeah, I'm pretty mad at Munger.
Chinese takes.
Yeah. I don't know. He's Munger's brilliant. I learned so much from him. He's disappointing me with some of his pro CCP rhetoric. But yeah, so I'll just, I'm just going to go so past Seth, that. No, Seth, but I think
the guy.
Huh? Pardon me?
Seth is the answer.
Yeah, I think I'd say Seth Klarman. I've learned a ton from Seth Klarman. I think the biggest thing is, you know, Buffett's got that quote, you know, rule number one, don't lose money. You know, rule number two, don't forget rule number one. But I'm a little bit more in the camp of rule number one is don't lose real purchasing power. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Like the decision to maintain large amounts of cash over such an extended period of time have cost Balpos and their investors real purchasing power. That is, and honestly, if stocks go lower, there's a lot of things you can do creatively, like to play offense. A really good investor, like, you know, should want a sell-off and should want panicking in that opportunity. They should hope that if they are a really good investor, that they will, even though they'll emotionally be, you know, I'm sure feeling things as well, be able to be slightly more rational than other market participants in the middle of the chaos. So I actually don't think that investors need to plan or worry too much about market sell-offs. One, because I think you should be either doing one of two things, but you should be passively indexing. Or two, if you actually do have the intestinal fortitude, you know, to be a really good active investor, you know, you should just trust that you're going to be able to, you know, things will take care of themselves. Like opportunities will present themselves if there's dislocations, and you should be able to play some offense. I actually think one of the risks is, you know, if I think right now, market was at 17 times earnings at one point last year, kind of forward earnings, and earnings estimates looked, you know, it was a scary situation coming out of COVID, but earnings estimates looked, you know, probably depressed if you looked out a couple years. Not probably, they were depressed if you looked out a couple years. And then, you know, with everything going on, yields had moved significantly lower. And, you know, the market was at 17 times forward earnings. And it was just a question of like, all right, we gotta, like, what's the real risk that we, you know, we sell off another 20% or that stocks move up, stocks move higher? This equity risk premium, you know, goes back to where it was. And so, you know, the yield on stocks tighten versus the 10-year, the yield on stocks moves lower / the multiple moves up. Like, and if that happens, like, you've permanently missed that. And so actually I struggle with, you know, Klarman's had so much cash for all these years, and he's almost done it to a point now. It's like, it doesn't matter how much the market sells off for him to be able to, like, actually, you know, just be in line with the market over the last 10 years. So I love Klarman, but I learned a lot from him. But I actually think one of the biggest things I've learned from him is cash is very dangerous. Holding large amounts of cash is very dangerous. I think it's, you know, at times you can hold some cash, but you almost need to tie yourself to the mast. Like, cash is a siren song. It will keep calling you, and it will feel really good when you have it, when the market is selling off, and it will feel like oxygen. But over any extended period of time, you're better off holding equities than cash. And so I think for me also, part of what I just do to make sure that I'm comfortable investing in equities is to not try to have this, like, massive special situations portfolio. Is I can sleep at night if the price of, you know, Sherwin-Williams is down 20%. And I'm not saying Sherwin-Williams is like some great investment from here, but just like, I'm don't hear me saying that, but I'm just using that as like a typical, like, really high quality business. Like, stock's down 20%. Like, it's been around since Civil War. It's not going anywhere. Like, I'm not freaking out. You know, if I own a bunch of Japanese banks and, you know, Korean manufacturers, like, my head's probably spinning trying to figure out what to do as the market sell off. But I think just owning a collection of high quality businesses really helps behaviorally just to stay fully invested. So, Klarman.
Love it. And then we'll just wrap up on this one. What does doing business the right way mean to you?
Doing business the right way, what does it mean to me? I think, you know, I think first off is, like, having integrity in all of your interactions. And I think that's something that is very easy to say, much more difficult to do. I actually think it's kind of a, you know, there can be a lot of hand wringing that goes in, like, what does it take to be a good man? Or what does it take to be a good woman? But actually at the end of the day, like, I think it's a pretty basic, you know, set of principles, and people can argue about it at the margins, but, it's just much harder to do, than it is to actually, be. And so, you know, I think, you know, doing business the right way really starts with starts with your personal life. And like, one thing I'll just say is, like, a lot of guys I know who are into business, like, care a lot about learning about business and learning about, you know, growing their business, making more money. But I think it's equally important, like, to constantly throughout the course of your life, be growing in character, and be asking yourself, like, you know, what does it mean for me to be a good man? What does it mean for me to be a good, for me, a good husband, eventually, hopefully one day, a good father, a good employee. And so I really kind of think of you, you know, look at life as less of, you know, and I'm religious, I'm a Christian. And so for me, that just ends up serving as is a reminder that my, you know, my audience for me is not, you know, is not even my employer or, you know, my friends or family or, but that for me, I believe I've got a one person audience. And so doing business the right way is really just trying to in all my interactions, make sure that I, you know, I can stand before that one person audience with a clear conscience. So that for me is what doing business the right way is, you know, different people, I'm sure over the years will have different, you know, you'll have interactions with people and there'll be times where both people feel wrong leaving a situation. But I really think there is, you know, it's easy in a way, it's hard to keep it, but it's easy to have an internal scorecard and to really just have a set of core values that you believe in and in your business interactions and in your personal interactions. Do your best to stick to like those core values, whatever those are for you. And that's kind of like, I'll end on this just, you know, there's different people who believe different things, but like there's two type of like people that I've met. There's people with a code and people without a code. And like, it's, you know, I'm a Christian. That's, you know, the clearly the code I've chosen, like the way I live, like, but you know, there's people that I do business with, I would interact with, and like I trust a lot to or not, you know, the same religion as me or have the same beliefs as me. But one thing that I do, you know, both who believe in a God and don't believe in a God, it's not, but I think there is a deep, like some individuals have a code, and they live by that code and others don't. And I strongly believe in pretty quickly in a conversation or just an interaction with someone, you can figure out, is this someone who has a code? Is this someone who has integrity? Like it may not even match yours perfectly, but like they've got a set of rules that's right and wrong that they're not breaking. And I think it's much easier to do business and interact with people who kind of have that internalized.
Totally. I totally agree with that. And I know Benton does as well. Bonsi, that was really informative and interesting and just really appreciate your time. I think our audience is going to really appreciate it and learn a lot. So thanks so much. And really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, quite welcome. Thank you guys for having me and look forward to continuing to listen to the podcast.
Got a couple of stock ideas I need to go start researching now.
Yeah. Oh, hey, feel free to run them by, man. Feel free to run them by.
Will do.
Awesome. Thank you guys.
This is Benton here again. Thanks so much for listening to the Circle of Competence podcast. To find more episodes like this one, go to circleofcompetence.co. That's circleofcompetence.co to sign up for my weekly podcast emails, as well as a monthly summary of links to blog posts and articles I liked most from the previous month. Finally, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating on iTunes, which will help more people discover the work we are doing to explore the entrepreneurial investor's journey. Thanks again for listening.